Hey, welcome back to Politico Tech. Today's Friday, April 5th. I'm your host, Stephen Overlake. The Biden administration is in the midst of its latest diplomatic reset with China, its geopolitical rival on all things tech. And Mike Froman is a guy who knows all about diplomatic resets. That's because for many years, he was a senior figure in Washington, shaping trade and economic policy. Most notably, he served as the U.S. Trade Representative during President Barack Obama's second term. And really, that's the last time the U.S. chased after sweeping new trade agreements. Donald Trump rode into the White House on a populist anti-trade wave. And it's one of the few policy areas where Joe Biden hasn't really changed course. Even Froman himself no longer subscribes to that same free trade ethos of the Obama years, especially when it comes to China.
We had the expectation that over time, China would become more like us. Instead, we have become more like China.
Ambassador Froman is now the president of the Council on Foreign Relations. He sees the U.S. becoming increasingly protectionist, especially on tech issues. But he says that's a rational policy position to take. After all, Froman tells me, China started it. Ambassador, appreciate you making time to join us on Politico Tech.
Thanks for having me.
Of course. A lot of issues to talk about here at the intersection of tech and geopolitics. I'd like to start, though, with the U.S.-China relationship, because it's once again front and center this week. President Biden had a phone call with Chinese President Xi Jinping. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen is over in China now for meetings. You know, for both sides, emerging tech has been kind of a key point of contention and concern. I'd like to hear from your perspective what you think Biden can do to move the needle on that relationship.
Well, first of all, I think looking back over the last few decades, there was an expectation as we brought China into the international trading regime that they would follow a certain set of rules. And I think there was disappointment over time that they were not necessarily following those set of rules, and they were engaging in policies that had the effect of undermining manufacturing around the world, competitive industries around the world. We're now keenly sensitive to what's going on with emerging technology and how do we make sure that we don't see what happened in, let's say, the solar panel market happen in markets related to emerging technology. So getting ahead of the curve and ensuring that, you know, one, we're diversifying supply chains, that we're not overly dependent on one country, just on China or any one country, that we are doing what we need to rebuild our own industrial base and ensure that we're maintaining a leadership role on the most critical technologies, whether they're relevant to national security or intelligence or more broadly to the economic competitiveness of the United States. So I think that's what the Biden administration is trying to do. There's inevitably going to be tension there with China, who has benefited enormously from the previous approach. And so I think China is trying to adjust to what we're doing. We're trying to adjust our policies to ensure that we don't fully decouple, that we continue to trade with China to our benefit where it's not strategic, but to take the actions necessary to achieve those other objectives.
Well, that's a fine line to walk, and I kind of want to get into that a bit with you, because the key complaint when I talk to U.S. officials seems to be that, you know, China subsidizes companies, that results in cheap products flooding the global market, and now there's concerns that will include electric vehicles and other clean technologies, things like that. I guess the issue I keep coming back to, though, is that the Biden administration itself is now providing billions of dollars in subsidies to industries, chips, clean energy, et cetera. It kind of starts to look like a case of do as I say, not as I do. What do you think?
Well, I would perhaps go even one step further, which is I think we had the expectation that over time, China would become more like us. Instead, we have become more like China. So we have now engaged in a certain degree of protectionism. We have tariffs on Chinese exports to the United States.
Right.
We've engaged in restrictions on foreign investment, which we also have criticized China for in the past in terms of not allowing firms to fully participate in their market through foreign investment. And we've engaged in full-scale industrial policy, at least with regard to a couple of these critical sectors like chips, like EVs and clean energy technologies. And so, to be frank, I think there's a little bit of, if you can't beat them, join them after having had only limited success in modifying Chinese behavior. I think the reaction is when it comes to these new technologies, either because they're so critical to our overall competitiveness, as well as our military and intelligence capabilities, or because they are clearly a horizon of the future that we want to be a full participant in the areas of electric vehicles, batteries, other clean energy technologies, that we're not going to wait until there's a flooding of the market with Chinese products. We're going to try and get ahead of the curve and take the actions necessary to be able to play significantly in those sectors as well.
I'm curious how you kind of feel about this shift of the U.S. toward more protectionist policies. I mean, you kind of came through government at a time when the thinking was the more integrated we are, the stronger we are. You were negotiating big multinational trade deals. Are you surprised at where we are, or do you think that this makes sense?
Well, look, I think we have to learn from the experiences that we've had over the last 20 years. I mean, you're right. I was involved in negotiating certain trade arrangements precisely to bring countries together to set standards counter to China, as an alternative to China. I think that was part of that reflection there. But I think we've also learned that we have to have a certain degree of humility about our ability to change Chinese policy. The Chinese have been very explicit, quite clear, quite public about what their aspirations are in terms of being able to be dominant or try to seek dominance in a number of critical technologies, the China 2025 strategy, for example.
Right.
And I think we have to take China at its word that that is its objective. And if that's its objective, then we have to take actions that are appropriate from our side. And, you know, as China became more explicit about those objectives over the last 6-7 years, I think that our policies have had to evolve as well.
One of the ways policy has evolved is the use of export controls or trade restrictions, right, when it comes to China. We've seen this a lot in tech, especially with chips. We saw it under President Trump and continued under President Biden. Administrations have argued that's necessary for national security. The Chinese have sort of argued it's just the U.S. being protectionist and trying to stifle its own growth. I'm curious how you see the use of export controls right now. Is that the right approach to kind of cutting off China's access to these critical technologies?
Look, I think we've had export controls in U.S. policy for decades. It used
right.
to be directed mostly against the Soviet Union and Warsaw Pact countries during the Cold War. Then as China emerged, they became applied to China as well. And so this is the next evolution of something that's already very much been on the books for a long time. Like, there's no doubt that China is a broad-based, multidimensional competitor of the United States
mm-hmm.
from an economic, political, and increasingly from a military and strategic point of view. And there is nothing wrong with a policy that says that we are not going to enable our chief competitor through the export of technology that could further strengthen their capacity in those areas at our expense. I think the question is, to what degree does it remain limited, or is it limited to military intelligence capabilities? And to what degree does it become a foundation or a platform to say, well, we need to have export controls to maintain our overall economic competitiveness, even if it's not related to military or intelligence capabilities?
And have we tipped over into that?
I don't think we've slipped over yet, but I think when you create a system, and the administration's talked about a small yard, a high fence around a small yard, you know, the question is, how small is that yard? And once you create that system and you create the precedent, does it become an avenue for any degree of competition or any supply chain that we're concerned about overdependence on? And so I think that's the concern that we all have to keep in mind. You know, I want to go back to, in some ways, to your previous question, because, you know, you asked whether I was surprised by the direction of our policy here. Look, I think it is totally a rational approach to restrict access and restrict market access to products that could damage us from a military and from a strategic point of view. We have a lot of non-strategic trade with China. The Biden administration has said, we're not interested in decoupling, we're only interested in de-risking. I think that's right, because there could be a very robust, and there is a very robust, trading relationship continuing to go on with China, provided we're not spilling over into these strategic products that have these other policy implications. And I think that's where we need to retain the focus. And we probably need to further develop a framework for being able to make those kinds of decisions about what's in the yard and what's outside the yard so that it doesn't become an excuse for further protectionism.
You know, I've heard this sort of decoupling versus de-risking argument a lot, and I do think sometimes the lines of that get a little bit blurred. But one question I have with it is, as you were saying earlier, you know, we've tried in the past sort of bringing China into the global system and seeing the limitations of that. Can this sort of de-risking strategy of being partially in, partially out with China actually evoke the kind of change that U.S. government thinks is needed?
In terms of changing Chinese behavior?
Right.
Look, I'm not optimistic about that. I think what it will do instead is require them, which they were already very much on the path towards, but will perhaps accelerate their efforts to go it alone, to create their own autonomous capability in this area. You know, right now, we believe that we are ahead of China in a number of these emerging technologies, including having advanced chips at scale. Our restriction of export of those chips and of the equipment to make those chips, I think will further accelerate China's efforts to try and develop their own capability. Whether or not they'll be able to catch up or not, whether we'll be able to maintain a lead and how long that lead is, I think that all remains to be seen. But we should remember, I hate to sound like a seventh grader on the playground, you know, we didn't start this. You know, China's been engaged in industrial policy for a long time. They made clear that they were going to do everything they could within their power
right.
to subsidize, to export, to create excess capacity, to achieve domination in a whole series of emerging technologies. They've been at it for a decade. We've been at it for about 3 years. And, you know, if you go back even further, Japan did it in the 1980s. Korea has done it. It's not something that the U.S. Has invented. I think, in fact, we've come quite late to it because we've always been somewhat skeptical about our ability to engage in industrial policy. And, you know, and now we're engaged in a very serious way, both with regard to chips and with regard to EVs and batteries and clean energy technology. And we'll see how those policies play out.
I mean, with that being said, I guess, do you feel like this dynamic between the U.S. and China is in a much different place now compared to when Biden entered office 3 years ago?
Well, I think right now we're in a pretty stable place in the relationship. You know, we went through a pretty difficult phase in 2023.
Right.
As we recall, it was 14, 15 months ago, we had the balloon incident.
Balloon gate,
all the
yes.
diplomatic contacts, balloon gate.
Yeah.
All the diplomatic contacts were cut off. Areas of potential cooperation, including around climate change, were very difficult to do. We've slowly gotten back there. I think the Woodside Summit in November helped draw a line under the relationship, stabilize it. It reflected the interest of both countries in having a stable relationship throughout this year, which is an important year, both in terms of the elections that we saw in Taiwan in January and, of course, our own election in November.
Well, so that's you walked right into my next question, which is, you know, we are facing an election in November. There is the prospect that former President Donald Trump could return to the White House. Obviously, we've heard his rhetoric on the campaign trail talking about China, this idea of more tariffs and kind of a return to some of his policy positions. How would a return of Trump change the dynamic here?
Well, I think there's been a fair degree of continuity. I mean, this is one of the few areas of policy where there's a pretty broad consensus, Republicans
sure,
and Democrats
yeah.
In Congress, and a fair degree of continuity between the Biden administration and the Trump administration. I think the Biden administration has been more attuned to working with allies and partners as part of this approach. I think when we talk to people around the world, I think the concern that others have is that the Trump administration is more likely to go it alone than to collaborate with allies and partners. I think that could be one potential area of difference. And as you said, there have been various proposals talked about, from putting a 10% tariff on all imports into the United States to putting a 60% tariff on China's exports to the United States, to withdrawing permanent normal trade relations status from China legislatively. So those would all be incremental to what we're doing now. But I think the fundamental strategy of having a strategic approach to China that recognizes that it is a broad-based competitor, that it seeks to achieve dominance in a series of technologies that we feel are important to our own national security and our own competitiveness, and therefore that we need to take action around, I think that's likely to be pretty continuous from one administration to another.
We'll be right back. I'm curious if you were back in the room yourself right now, is there something you wish you could be doing or you would be doing on this?
Well, one thing we should want to do in government and those of us outside of government is to make explicit what the trade-offs are in pursuing alternative approaches. So we dislike our dependence on China for a whole series of products. We also dislike inflation and the high cost of living, right? And the actions taken to lower our dependence on China through reshoring, nearshoring, changing of our supply chains, it's likely to make products more expensive than they otherwise would. We're no longer going for the most efficient way of production. We're going for the most resilient, the most redundant, the most secure supply chains. That's a perfectly legitimate trade-off to make, but we shouldn't pretend as that it's free. And we should have that conversation among politicians, policymakers, legislators, and the American public of what is the trade-off that we're talking. How much more are we willing to pay for the products that we consume every day in order to be less dependent on China? And are there certain products where it's very important to pay that price and other products where it's less important to pay that price?
Well, it seems like a very difficult message to try to deliver politically, right? Is we need to pay more for these products for national security. It's in some ways a hard political sell.
Well, it's a hard political sell, but that's the reality. And I think it's disingenuous to say we can pursue this alternative approach to China and face no cost ourselves. And so, you know, the same is obviously true of tariffs more broadly. It's the consumer and the importers of inputs into manufacturing in the United States who pay the cost of increased tariffs. And therefore making that clear and having the debate. And it's efficiency and low cost production is not the only value in a supply chain. There is value in resilience, redundancy, and security, but we have to weigh what the costs and benefits are and then make a judgment accordingly.
If we zoom out a bit, you know, these tensions between the U.S. and China have kind of added to the strain that global institutions have been under in recent years, right? And, you know, I know you wrote last year that there are sort of real questions about the limits of multilateralism. One question I have been sort of turning around in my own head is, are these global tech issues, things like chips and supply chains, but also artificial intelligence, are those tech issues going to heal those fractures or add to them?
Look, I don't think they're going to heal them. I don't know whether they're going to fracture them further or not. I think if you take AI as an example, you know, right now we have a patchwork quilt of approaches. So we have the voluntary standards in the U.S. that then became part of the executive order. We've got the Bletchley Conference, where China was a participant, to talk about some of the rules of the road for AI. We have an agreement now between the U.S. and the U.K. to share information about the review of models. We're in the very initial innings of trying to figure out what international governance around emerging technology like AI looks like.
Right.
And whether we're going to be doing it among like-minded countries, to what degree we can do it with China, where we may have very different views on privacy, on the use of data, on the use of models. And I think it's a very difficult and important set of issues. And, you know, at Woodside at the summit in November, President Biden, President Xi agreed to launch an AI dialogue. I think those are potentially positive signs. But if it's a dialogue that's intended just to slow us down, then obviously that's not going to be very productive. If it's a dialogue to flesh out where we might have common interests, for example, not taking the human being out of the decision making over the use of a nuclear weapon.
Right.
Seems like a very basic, fundamental issue that we ought to all be able to agree on. But we don't have any international framework for it right now. And so I think a lot of further work to do to see when it comes to AI, where do we have common interests and can we begin to build up a regime of cooperation around that? Jury is still out.
Is that a good place to start when it comes to that kind of these defense questions? Like that, it seems existentially, right? There, it doesn't get much more dire than the idea of AI-driven warfare.
I think it's a good place to start in that, you know, particularly when you use something as extreme an example of human decision-making around the use of nuclear weapons. If we can't agree on that, it's hard to imagine what we can agree on when it comes to AI. Hopefully it doesn't just stop there, but it goes further to look at the other risks around AI so that we can fully take advantage of the benefits of AI. I mean, ultimately, that's what this is about, which is tremendous benefits that can come with emerging technologies. How do we mitigate the risks that may come along with them so that we can fully enjoy the benefits?
In the tech space, there's been a lot of focus at the moment around U.S. positions on digital trade issues globally, right? There's this, you know, the Biden administration has taken some steps to walk back past U.S. digital trade positions in a move that has largely been seen as kind of agreeing with advocacy organizations that say there needs to be more regulation of big tech on issues like data privacy and algorithms, et cetera. Do you think the administration is taking the right approach here in kind of reevaluating those digital trade positions, given so much of our commerce now is driven by data, driven by the internet, and soon driven by AI?
You know, as you said, so much of our economy is dependent on data. And you know, certainly the whole services sector, which is an increasingly large part of our economy, but also manufacturing. Mm-hmm. Manufacturing is the line between manufacturing and services, or between data and manufacturing, is a very permeable line. So if you care about manufacturing, you need to care about what the rules of the road are around data as well. The U.S. has been a strong advocate for a long time around the world for high standards around the digital economy and around data. And I think there is sort of a fresh look at some of those principles. And my hope is that even as there is that fresh look, that we won't ignore the very important interests that we have at stake in creating rules of the road that reflect our interests and our vision for the digital economy. Because if we don't set the rules of the road, then others will. China will, or others will. And I'm pretty sure that if they're setting the rules of the road with a very different view of data, it's not going to be in the interest of our economy and consistent with our values.
Is there a void that has kind of been created in terms of U.S. leadership on the global stage on some of these issues, especially on digital? That's one thing I've heard in the trade context. I covered the Indo-Pacific Economic Framework negotiations and questions around, you know, whether the U.S. was leaving this void for China to fill in the Asia-Pacific. And I just wonder if you, you know, look at the state of play, where you see U.S. leadership right now.
The rest of the world wants the U.S. to be engaged, wants the U.S. to show leadership. Even when they resist that leadership sometimes, they want the U.S. at the table because they know that, you know, without the U.S. there, then there is going to be a void others will seek to fill. I'll take one area in particular. You know, I think China over the years has been much more focused than the U.S. on areas like standard setting. Standard setting is an incredibly technical, detailed, not always a headline-grabbing set of issues, but it's important because if we're at the table helping to set the standards versus China driving the standards, it's going to be a very different world, not just for our companies, but for our people. And so I think it's something that we need to be very much focused on, is how to maintain that engagement and that leadership consistent with our national interests. And I get it that there are interests in regulating big tech, that there's a lot going on in the data space that are still a work in progress. We want to make sure that we can address issues as they arise. But there are still areas where I think the U.S. can demonstrate leadership and engagement.
Well, Ambassador, I could pick apart these issues all day, but I appreciate your time joining us here on Politico Tech.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's all for today's Politico Tech. For more tech news, subscribe to our newsletters, Digital Future Daily and Morning Tech. Music in today's episode comes from the mysterious Breakmaster Cylinder. Our managing producer is Annie Reese. Our producer is Afra Abdullah. And our editors are Steve Heuser, Daniela Cheslow, and Louisa Savage. I'm Stephen Overley. Have a good weekend. I'll see you back here on Monday.